not going to pretend it was easy. Hell, those first few months were awful for everyone. It was a terrible thing not knowing what's going on, and in the next few years were even worse. We all had to watch friends and families torn apart by this thing, and at first we had no idea what it was. Best guess, it started somewhere in Europe and spread from there, maybe came over with someone or in their bag. Heck, maybe even their dog or cat. All we knew for sure was that a few months after the first reports, it was everywhere. I mean everywhere. Whatever this was, it was crossing oceans, invading homes, tearing through hospitals. It didn't care, and we all lost people at first. A year or so in, the daily grind ground to a halt, and things were different. Your 9-to-5 didn't matter anymore. People stopped going into work, and eventually, nobody cared. It was just too dangerous. At a certain point, there weren't enough people to keep businesses open, or at least not enough people that cared to go in. People changed. They just sort of went tribal or something. For a while, things went crazy and people started looting and setting fires and everyone was scared. It was only 6 or 7 months before we figured out roughly what it was, but that was more than enough time for it to get out of control and beyond containing. Eventually, they were able to trace the thread back and figure out what it was. CNN had the honor of telling the world what was tearing it to shreds. And that's how we learned about it. The fucking nightly news. The virus, which was called KV-571, originated in a medical research facility near Cambridge, England. Don't ask me what it stands for. Some science thing, I'm sure. How's anything named? For all I know, KV stands for killer virus. And the numbers? I don't know. Maybe it's somebody's birthday or something. You throw everyone in the office's birthday on a list, and if yours is closest to that day, then lucky you, you get a virus named after you. Who knows where these things come from? As I understood it, it was initially being tested as a cancer treatment by one of those hotshot millionaire types. You know the ones. They have more money than they know what to do with, and they want to solve all the world's problems while cutting out the middleman that is the big bad government, all while making a buck. It was supposed to work as sort of a bloodhound virus. You give it a whiff of cancerous cells and let it loose. In theory, it would scour every surface of the body looking for that scent, and then it would attack until it was gone. And it worked, too, at least on a small scale. They ran the gamut of the usual tests on rats and dogs and pigs, and eventually, individual human organs. And it was doing exactly what it was supposed to do. It was a wonder drug. But the issue they were having was what to do with it after it killed the cancer cells. Nobody liked the idea of having a rogue killer virus just sitting in them for the rest of their life, so they played around with different viruses to kill the initial one. But it wound up being a veritable, there was an old lady who swallowed a fly situation. And we all know how that turned out. Eventually, they figured out a way to basically turn it off, but it was still there. It just wasn't active. But that was good enough for science, and apparently the drug hit the market. Well, sort of. I mean, they were a private company and they were doing private things in private company ways. The folks down on Capitol Hill and all the big pharma jockeys were getting the shaft and they did not like that. So for a while there, it was almost a black market thing. You know, Robin Hood. Robbing from the rich big pharma and giving to the poor cancer victims. You'd hear rumors and whispers of so-and-so who couldn't afford conventional treatments, but they knew a guy who could get them in touch with someone whose cousin maybe could get them the KV-571. A little bit sketchy, right? Well, that's what the FDA thought too, apparently. But after enough people had enough startlingly positive results, someone had to listen. The government, fearing an uprising, saw the light and went ahead and greenlit the drug for mass production. There was just too much money to be made. And the results were amazing. It really did everything they said it would, and it was way safer than any other cancer treatment out there. No more watching your sick kids wither away with conventional chemotherapy. And typically, only one treatment was necessary. It didn't matter what stage the cancer was in. The virus was smart. It could reproduce itself as needed depending on how many enemy cells there were. And after all its hard work, it would just pack up and go to sleep. Again, it was amazing. But the problems came a year or so later. It was what happens to every smart sleeping predator eventually. It woke up. And when KV-571 woke up, it was hungry. It seemed to start small and ramp up over time. Most often it would start with the immune system. You'd get the sniffles and assume you had a cold when actually you were being eaten alive from the inside out. From there, it would move on to more noticeable things like your spleen, a lung, or an eye. And after that, well, that's when things got a little more twisted. Sometimes it would eat away at your skin, or your hair would fall out along with your nails. But despite all that, it needed a host, so it kept you alive. It would wreak just enough havoc to keep itself alive, while leaving enough alone or repairing enough along the way to keep your basic vital organs running relatively smoothly. And eventually, you were more KV-571 than anything else. At a certain point, of course, well, it would run out of real estate and you would die. But in most cases, you were a walking, talking, flesh-eating virus for several months before you knew what was going on, and at least a year or so before you finally died. That is, if you didn't end it yourself first. A full year. And according to my admittedly limited research, a panel of people much smarter than myself estimate that the average healthy person sneezes upward of 600 times per year. You had a crappy immune system, sprinkled liberally with a killer virus, and presto, you have destruction. And that's not even taking into account all of the kissing and touching and cuddling we humans like to do, spread like wildfire. A week or two in, however, and I guarantee you there wasn't a single person who wouldn't have gladly traded what we now had for the uncontrollable blaze of a wildfire. At least with a wildfire, you could see the smoke coming and knew where to avoid. Partly, thanks to CNN and other mass media outlets, in our now paranoid minds, everyone with a cold or a headache was a shambling, disease-infested creature out of some George Romero film, just waiting to tear us to shreds. Of course, this wasn't true. Not everyone with a tickle in their throat was out for brains. We still had a flu season. We still had allergies, and the nerve endings in our nose were still just as sensitive to pepper. The difference was, you had no idea whether or not that tickle in your throat meant that a year from now, you, and in all likelihood, everyone you loved would be dead and rotting in a mass grave somewhere. Now sure, early on they had tests to see if someone was carrying KV-571, but no one wanted to administer them on the off chance that even a handful of people tested positive. By all accounts, the virus was so contagious, that meant that the administrators would probably get it, and it wasn't worth the risk. Later, I guess some brainiacs at Harvard figured out that people deserved to know whether they were screwed or not. So they came up with a PDHTS, or Personal Disposable Home Testing Set. It was like the pregnancy test from hell. You open it up, piss on a stick, and read your fortune. Red, you're dead, or green, you live to die another day. There were a lot of tears when those things came out. I wish I could say more of them were the happy, joy, and relief type. But red, you're dead. Testing became part of our daily routine, like brushing our teeth. We tested when we got up, we tested before we went to bed. And looking back, I wish I'd bought stock in those stupid little piss sticks. I'd probably be a multimillionaire or something by now. Not that that mattered anymore, but hey, something I could have crossed off my bucket list. In a twisted sort of way, this thing actually did a lot of good for people, too. You know, minus all the carnage, I guess. People washed their hands more, they took their vitamins, and they started eating healthier, exercise regularly, and everyone took their tests at least twice a day. Anything you could do to generally stay as healthy as possible. Because the less scares, the better. After a while, people just got used to it. There was a new normal, and that's just how it was. And some people even went back to work for a while. We had to get food and clothing from somewhere, and and the big cities weren't exactly set up for hunter-gatherer societies. Plus, how could we call ourselves Americans and not try to make a buck while all this shit was going on? But again, take it with a grain of salt. We didn't have big corner office executives anymore. Nobody was working 80 hours a week, punching a time clock to be in some cubicle. Grocery stores did okay, and big box stores stayed afloat for a while. There was usually a Starbucks in sight, right? But the world was nothing like it was before. Instead of the pimply-faced kid whose manhood hadn't fully decided between up or down bagging your groceries, you had the guy who used to be the most expensive divorce lawyer in the tri-state area asking you, paper or plastic? Status was a thing of the past now, and the playing field had been leveled. And it wasn't just that less people went to work now either, or the bigwigs were now flipping burgers. People changed. And not just some people, everyone changed. Our once loud, obnoxious social society was now scared, paranoid, timid, and solitary. We were like a city full of rats now scurrying from one hole to the next. And you rarely saw more than a few of us together at one time. It was like going out after a snowstorm when the world just shuts down. No people, no cars, and that unnatural quiet that made you wonder if the streetlights were always this loud or if your pants always swished like this. It wasn't so much living anymore as just plain old surviving. And if you're out there, and if you're listening to this somewhere, then I think you know. All things considered, I think we did it pretty darn well. There were essentially four types of people in this new little world of ours. You had your angry, post-apocalyptic, Second Amendment-wielding, kill-anything-that-coughs types. It was amazing how many of those came out of the woodwork. People you never expected were out there leading that charge. But then, you also had the inconsolable, scared to death, what has this world become, paralyzed with grief crowd. Sometimes they were even harder to deal with than the outlaw gunslinger types. At least they could form complete sentences without bawling their eyes out and snotting down their faces. It was sad, though. A lot of the criers were the ones who asked to borrow a rope and never had a chance to give it back. I guess they figured it was easier than not knowing. And there's something to be said for that, too. Don't get me wrong, I'm not supporting suicide. But in a world like ours, I just get it, I guess. My sister was in that crowd. Her name was Rachel. Rachel Catherine Gray. Catherine was our grandmother's name on her dad's side, and she always loved her middle name. I can remember when she was little, sometimes she would march downstairs, nose in the air, and declare, with no small amount of pomp, that she no longer desired to be called Rachel, and that we were to address her as Catherine now. But then a few months later, she would change it back. She was always finicky like that. But we played along. One day her favorite color was blue, and the next it was pink, and on and on and on. Rachel was younger than me by about 2 years, and I always took pride in my role as a big brother. But when my mom and dad caught the virus, I just didn't know what to do. They obviously left their home not wanting to spread it more. Rachel was a wreck, and I wasn't much better off. Maybe a little, but not much. I couldn't even say goodbye. There was no contact. That was the rule to survive. I tried to stay strong for Rachel, but a few months later, I guess she was tired of fighting. I went over to her house to bring her some soup that I'd made and found her slumped over the kitchen table. You can imagine, it was an awful day. She'd written a note that was folded neatly next to her crumpled body, said all the usual stuff, why she'd done it and why she was sorry for not being stronger, not to blame myself, and that I was the best big brother a little sister could ask for. I managed to make it almost to the end of the note before I lost it completely. The last thing she wrote was, "Keep your nose out of the dirt, kiddo." And she signed it Rachel. That was something we used to say to each other all the time. "Keep your nose out of the dirt, kiddo." Rachel was a clumsy kid, always falling down. And I used to say that to her every day before she left for school. And she knew it was my way as an awkward teenage boy at the time to tell my kid sister that I loved her. It became our little code. But God, we hadn't said that in years. That's when I lost it, when I read that last line. Keep your nose out of the dirt, kiddo. For a while there, I was a part of that second group, the inconsolable ones. I must have sat there for an hour, bawling my face off with my sister's lifeless body lying there next to me. I threw up a couple of times, didn't even try to make it to the bathroom, didn't even get up. It was one of those times when you really don't care that you have spit and tears and snot and vomit just dripping off of you. Those things didn't matter. But after a while, I was able to pull myself together enough to stand up. I rinsed my face, tore off that last bit of note, and I gently put it in my shirt pocket. Kissed my sister one last time, burned the rest of the note, and I left that house forever. Because I wasn't in that second group. I fit into the third group of people. We were the ones who, no matter what, just tried to survive. We looked at the world and said, well, this sucks, but it is what it is. We did what we needed to do to survive and get through to the next day. Then there's the last group. One country club membership you didn't see people lining up for. They had high fees, terrible benefits, and no little umbrellas in their drinks. And oh yeah, Red, you're dead. If you just didn't seem to fit into any of the other three groups, chances are at that point, you were probably a breaker. Short for outbreak patients, and that's what we called them. Breakers. I guess I haven't introduced myself yet. My name is Shepherd Gray. I started these recordings first out of boredom, I guess, as a way of keeping a record of my journey. Writing things down didn't seem to work for me. Anything I scroll down is in my virtually indecipherable handwriting that looks like it was done by a right-handed toddler writing with his left-handed crayon. So I'm recording it here now for you. And I'm not naive. I was 28 years old at the time this all started, and I'd seen enough of the world to know that most people were looking out for number one, and most of the people who aren't at this point are breakers. But whoever you are, wherever you are, if you're out there listening to this, I'm Shepherd Gray, and this is my story. Breakers Podcast is brought to you each week by Sammy Walsh and me, Sam Culper. Join the Breakers communities across social media by searching at Breakers Podcast everywhere. And please, like, share, follow, subscribe, and review. We want to hear from you, so please let us know what you think about the show. Breakers Podcast is produced by executive producer Jay Russell, along with Lauren Robinson, Ben Cooper, and Michelle Campbell. And thank you to everyone who supports the show over at patreon.com/breakerspodcast. Special thanks to Michael Lipinski, who did our cover art, and also to all those folks over at the Sofa King Podcast, Podcasts We Listen To, and Underdog Podcast Communities. Go over and check those folks out and support independent podcasters. We'll see you next week, and remember, Red, you're dead.